pointing out the high cost of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. We knew that our numbers were conservative, but as time mounted on and the cost mounted up, what we've discovered is that the cost just of caring for our
we have 20 seconds
is in the trillions of dollars. The wars have been little benefit, but enormous cost to our society.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Joe Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist, Columbia University professor, former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. Among his books, People, Power, and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Nobody likes membership drives. At KBOO, we envision a community radio future with shorter drives. Help us reduce the duration of membership drives by making your contribution right now, before the drive starts. Just go to kboo.fm/give. Or mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Together, we can shorten membership drives for good.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council delays vote on Texas boycott. Misinformation clouds California gubernatorial recall. And in international news, the Taliban government announces drastic changes. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 8th, 2021. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. According to the Oregon Health Authority, the state saw 54 COVID deaths and 5,821 new cases over Labor Day weekend. 1,140 people are currently hospitalized from COVID-19, and 300 are in intensive care in the state. 62% of Oregonians are at least partially vaccinated, while regional ICUs are at 94% capacity. 80% of deaths last month were among unvaccinated or partially vaccinated Oregonians. Vaccination rates have plateaued at around 3,000 per day. The Centers for Disease Control warned individuals against traveling over the holiday, but the impact of the long weekend remains to be seen. Uncertainties surround the reopening of Oregon schools. This is the third school year impacted by COVID-19, and parents and educators are anxious for children's well-being, mental and physical. The Oregon Department of Education issued several advisories, including vaccinating educators and parents, reducing extracurricular activities, and holding others outside. Dr. Dean Seidlinger of the Oregon Health Authority issued a statement on COVID protections in Oregon schools, saying, quote, "The decisions we make over the next few weeks will determine whether we plunge deeper into this crisis of care or we reverse this rising tsunami." Portland City Council will vote on whether to ban certain trade with Texas over the state's unprecedented anti-abortion laws. However, that decision has been postponed. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
The Portland City Council is postponing its vote on a draft emergency resolution banning goods and services from Texas. The resolution was proposed in response to a Texas law which prohibits most abortions. Portland has had approximately $35 million in contracts with Texas-based businesses over the last 5 years. In addition, Portland employees have made 19 official business trips to the state since 2019. The resolution also bans employee travel to Texas. The mayor's office expected the resolution to be presented during a city council meeting on September 8th, but it has been postponed to better understand the impact of the ban. A statement from Mayor Ted Wheeler's office said, quote, "We urge other leaders and elected bodies around the nation to join us in condemning the actions of the Texas state government." End quote. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick responded to the threatened boycott, calling Portland a dumpster fire and describing its leaders as depraved. He said a boycott will hurt Portland citizens, not Texans. The Texas law prohibits abortions once a fetal heartbeat can be detected, which usually occurs at around 6 weeks, before many women even know they are pregnant. The United States Supreme Court recently declined to act on a motion blocking the Texas law from being applied. Mayor Wheeler said the Portland resolution would be in effect until Texas withdraws its abortion law or the law gets overturned in court. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
An air quality advisory is in place over Portland and much of Oregon as wildfire smoke and high temperatures settle in the region. Ash landed across the city, covering vehicles and irritating residents. Conditions are not yet considered severe. Wildfires last fall caused the city's air quality to drop to the lowest in the world and prompted residents to stay inside. According to findings by a professor at OHSU, Social Security benefits could be reduced by 24% in 2034 as a result of financial strain brought on by the pandemic. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
The pandemic presents some future funding challenges to benefits for older Americans, according to the 2021 Social Security and Medicare Trustees reports. Walt Dawson teaches in the Oregon Health and Science University School of Public Health. He says these programs are foundational to Americans' health and economic security as they age. While the reports are troubling, he notes they aren't exactly surprising, because a number of challenges to the Social Security program have been known for a long time.
But the COVID-19 pandemic has made the situation slightly worse and increased by 1 year when Social Security, for example, will no longer be able to pay out all benefits.
Dawson says without major policy changes, benefits would have to be reduced by 24% in 2034, which he thinks would be devastating for older Americans. He says it isn't only the pandemic and economic fallout to blame. A rapidly aging population is also a contributing factor. Bandana Shrestha, state director of AARP Oregon, is concerned lawmakers in Congress could make cuts to these critical programs behind closed doors.
We really think that these important programs need transparent public input, conversations that really allow us to make thoughtful decisions about the security and long-term stability of these programs.
Dawson believes the pandemic could be an inflection point in how Americans think about Social Security.
While there's this real need to fix the challenges that are facing this program, there's a real opportunity to think about how they can be enhanced and improved to provide for people, too.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants to keep Texas out of Oregon.
If it was only Texas, denying women the right to choose, denying many people the right to vote, but there's Florida, Mississippi, Arkansas, Arizona, just to name a few. States with more guns than people, states where being a person of color, having a different accent, or just not checking all the behavioral boxes means you're not welcome here. Remember the Alamo, the struggle to seize indigenous land and maintain slavery. Even here in Oregon, outside Portland where the Trump flags still fly, and inside Portland with a record number of gun deaths, like last week's road rage in Beaverton where the two drivers pulled their cars over, came out with their guns, and one killed the other. I've never wanted to live in Texas. Do I still have a choice? Come 2022 or 24, with Republicans controlling Senate, Congress, and White House, they already have the Supreme Court, the coup will be complete. I will never pledge allegiance to the United States of Texas. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
While Democratic voters outnumber Republicans in California nearly 2-1, a Republican effort to recall Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom is headed to the ballot box. Misinformation stoked by prominent Republicans, including former President Donald Trump, has led some voters to doubt the state's well-managed voting apparatus. With more, here's Suzanne Potter.
Myths and disinformation about the California recall election are getting traction on social media, but experts say instances of fraud are minuscule and county and state election security measures are robust. Kim Alexander with the California Voter Foundation says people can have confidence in the voting machines because the state requires they be stress tested and certified.
The counties are required to conduct pre-election tests on their equipment. They're required to conduct post-election audits to verify the results.
Recently, a man in Torrance was arrested for stealing mail, including 300 ballots. So the county destroyed those ballots and sent new ones. Alexander says occasionally a voter will receive two ballots, usually because they wrote a slightly different name when renewing their registration. But each ballot's barcode is tied to a unique voter, and only one vote will be counted. In addition, signatures are matched to the one on file. There have been questions as to why some counties include a small hole on either side of the signature line on the envelope. Alexander says it isn't intended to reveal the results.
It allows voters who are sight impaired to locate the area on the envelope where they need to sign their name or place their mark in order for their ballot to be counted. It also helps election officials verify after the election that every envelope is empty.
You can find trustworthy information about the recall from your county election board's website and the Secretary of State's website. The site, calvoter.org, also has a nonpartisan online voter guide, links to every county voting office, lookup tools to track your ballot, and a map of in-person voting sites. This story was produced with original reporting by Samia Kamal with Cal Matters. I'm Suzanne Potter for California News Service.
Texas's new election law was passed yesterday, limiting access to voting for thousands of Texans based on unsubstantiated allegations of electoral fraud. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It does make it easier than ever before for anybody to go cast a ballot. It does also, however, make sure that it is harder for people to cheat at the ballot box in Texas.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a controversial election reform bill into law Tuesday, which includes new restrictions on voting by mail, increased voter ID requirements, and gives more authority to partisan poll watchers. Texas Democratic U.S. Rep. Colin Allred calls it a solution in search of a problem.
We did not have any significant voter fraud in Texas in the last election. In fact, we had 11 million Texans vote. That was a great thing.
Opponents quickly filed suit claiming the law violates the state constitution. U.S. Capitol Police are developing a security plan ahead of a September 18th Justice for J6 rally to support the roughly 570 people charged in the January 6 riot. Some far-right members of Congress have questioned the treatment of the defendants, and several were denied access to view their conditions at the D.C. Department of Corrections. Secretary of State Antony Blinken disputes Republican claims the Taliban is holding Americans hostage. At a press conference from Qatar, he clarified there are a few U.S. citizens who have been unable to evacuate on chartered flights from a northern Afghan city.
Without personnel on the ground, we can't verify the accuracy of manifests, the identities of passengers, flight plans, or aviation security protocols. So this is a challenge.
Blinken said the Taliban assured the U.S. all American citizens and Afghan citizens with valid travel documents will be allowed to leave. The White House is asking Congress for $6 billion to help resettle 95,000 Afghans in the U.S. and $24 billion for natural disasters, including the aftermath of Hurricane Ida. President Joe Biden toured damage caused by the storm in New York and New Jersey on Tuesday and called it evidence of climate change.
Walking these neighborhoods, meeting the families and the first responders, seeing how folks are doing after this destruction and pain and another devastating storm is an eye-opener.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is dismissing calls from moderate Senator Joe Manchin to hit pause on Democrats' $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation package.
At the end of the day, after a lot of negotiations and pain, and I'm going to be on the phone all week, what we are going to do is pass the most comprehensive bill for working families that this country has seen in a long way with the 50 votes plus the vice president.
Manchin says he's concerned about the impact on inflation. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is rejecting rumors of a possible 2024 presidential run. DeSantis is a favorite among Republicans due to his opposition to COVID-19 mandates and hostility toward the media. His comments come as former President Donald Trump ramps up his own fundraising events. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Abortion is no longer a crime in Mexico. Mexico's Supreme Court yesterday ruled unanimously that a state law criminalizing abortion was unconstitutional, setting precedent for a national decriminalization. The court found that a law in the northern state of Coahuila punishing people who have abortions with 3 years imprisonment violates the nation's constitution. Those jailed under that law will be released. Supreme Court Chief Justice Arturo Saldivar said, "Today is a historic day for the rights of all Mexican women." It is a watershed in the history of the rights of all women, especially the most vulnerable. Mexico has the world's second largest Roman Catholic population. The Roman Catholic Church opposes all forms of abortion. A magnitude 7 earthquake in southwestern Mexico last night killed at least one person and could be felt as far as Mexico City, 231 miles away from the epicenter. Although no major damage was recorded in the capital, 1.6 million households nationwide lost electricity. Damage was most severe in Acapulco, where downed power lines and gas leaks worry residents and tourists. Mexico has faced many deadly earthquakes, but so far the consequences of yesterday's appear primarily psychological. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Noise Filter. Tonight's weather is clear, dropping from 83 degrees at 6 to 62 degrees in the early morning. Tomorrow's weather is warm with a high of 81. Today in 1504, Michelangelo revealed his statue of David to an audience in Florence. Originally intended as a symbol of the city-state's independence, the statue was positioned so it glared in the direction of Rome. The quote of the day is from Mark Twain. "The man who is ostentatious of his modesty is twin to the statue that wears a fig leaf." Electricity is being restored in Louisiana in the wake of Hurricane Ida, but the state now faces hundreds of oil spills and broken pipelines. The U.S. Coast Guard announced reports of nearly 350 oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico in the aftermath of Ida. With about 88% of the region's offshore oil production shut down and over 100 offshore oil production platforms still without crew, some spills may have been avoided, but there has been little done to limit leaks. The Louisiana Bucket Brigade, a fossil fuel industry watchdog, tweeted yesterday, quote, "This is the petrochemical industry's responsibility, so it should foot the bill for the total cleanup, not the taxpayer. Every pipeline in the Gulf and those across our bayous, backyards, and neighborhoods must be decommissioned at the first opportunity." Despite their greater need, low-income people may be less likely to receive federal loans after natural disasters such as hurricanes. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. After a hurricane, wildfire, or flood, many people rely on Small Business Administration loans to rebuild their homes. But not everyone can get these loans.
The problem is, the people who might not qualify because they have, say, a lower credit score, or maybe they have a lot of student loans and that's driving up their debt-to-income ratio, these people are also the ones who may need the most help in recovering after a disaster.
Emily Gallagher is an assistant professor of finance at the University of Colorado Boulder. She studied how relief aid was allocated to Houston residents whose homes flooded during Hurricane Harvey in 2017. She says people in some areas were far more likely to be denied loans.
It's definitely the case that these denials are falling harder on lower income communities, which also tend to be higher minority communities.
People who do not qualify for a loan can apply for cash grants from FEMA, but the grants are much smaller and are not always easy to get. So those who are most financially vulnerable may have the hardest time recovering after a disaster, despite programs intended to help. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The Taliban initiates its new regime in Afghanistan with several provocative decisions. Interim appointees have been named to head various government ministries, composed primarily of Taliban veterans and excluding any female appointments. Most troubling to foreign observers, the Ministry of the Interior will be led by Sarojuddin Haqqani, head of the Taliban's notoriously destructive Haqqani network and a wanted terrorist, according to the United States. The Haqqani network has also been alleged to cooperate with al-Qaeda. The United States has offered bounties on members of the Haqqani family totaling millions of dollars. Sirajuddin Haqqani will now have to turn his forces inward to deal with the threat of ISIS-K, Afghanistan's branch of the Islamic State. While the Taliban controls most of the country, fighting continues in the primarily Tajik Panjshir Valley, where members of the Republican government have joined forces with Ahmad Massoud, an anti-Taliban commander and son of the legendary general Ahmad Shah Massoud. Due to its narrow passes, ethnic makeup, and history of armed resistance, Panjshir has long been a stronghold for anti-Taliban forces. Rare protests continue against the Taliban's impositions against Afghan women. In the Islamic Republic, women could pursue university educations, leave home unveiled, and participate fully in public life. Now a litany of edicts threaten to reverse hard-won gains. Most recently, the Taliban announced that they would bar women from playing sports, claiming that it is both unnecessary and potentially provocative. Female-led protests in Kabul against the Taliban and their allies in Pakistan were met with arrests and beatings, although no killings have been reported. Former Prime Minister Ashraf Ghani, who taught economics at Berkeley and Johns Hopkins and spent a year in his teens at Lake Oswego High School in Oregon, fled Afghanistan on the day the Taliban took over. He issued his first public statements from the United Arab Emirates, apologizing to the Afghan people for leaving the country. Ghani defended his decision, saying that by abdicating, he may have prevented a bloody struggle for control of Kabul. Ghani has also denied allegations that he fled the capital with millions of government dollars. The Taliban's relationship with the United States remains tense. Almost $10 billion held by Afghanistan's National Bank are held by the United States, and it is uncertain whether the new government will have access to those reserves. A Boston-based civil rights group is ready to welcome Afghan refugees, but alleges that a lack of government transparency could hamper local efforts to help. With Public News Service, it's Lily Bolke.
Advocates for human rights and civil rights in Massachusetts are urging more transparency and clear information on plans to resettle Afghan refugees in Massachusetts and elsewhere. Communities across the Commonwealth are ready to welcome people fleeing the Taliban and Afghanistan, but Yvonne Espinosa-Madrigal with Lawyers for Civil Rights Boston notes there's been little concrete information on when they will arrive, how many will be coming to Massachusetts or where, and what their immigration status will be.
We are seeing a lot of interest at the municipal level with cities saying that they are ready to be able to welcome Afghan families, but a lot of uncertainty about when and if they will be arriving.
This Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of 9/11, after which began the 20-year war between the United States and the Taliban and Afghanistan. The Biden administration yesterday called on Congress to allocate more than $6 billion for resettlement efforts, and they've estimated roughly 80,000 Afghans will be eligible to come to the U.S. overall. Espinosa-Madrigal notes that what is happening in Afghanistan could mean that refugees are eligible for asylum status, especially people who supported U.S. military and intelligence operations, women, and LGBTQ people. But he adds it's one of multiple options for how refugees will be classified, and that decision has both short-term and long-term consequences. In the short term,
it matters to be able to have access to a host of services, including housing and other safety nets. And in the long term, how immigrants are classified can have lasting consequences on their ability to change status.
He adds the U.S. could be well served by following the example of other countries, such as Mexico, that have more quickly begun the resettlement process. Groups in the Commonwealth and other states are seeking support and volunteers, searching for housing, and forming welcoming committees. This is Lily Wolke with Commonwealth News Service.
British Parliament approved a large tax hike to support the National Health Service, making the UK one of the first developed nations to raise taxes to cover COVID expenses. Labour and some Conservative members of Parliament complained that the new law could financially burden working families and hinder economic recovery. Tax rates in the United Kingdom are setting records as the highest peacetime levels ever. Taxes are expected to continue rising as the country grapples with an aging population on top of pandemic-related expenses. Electricity is often lacking on Navajo reservations, especially on land overlapping with Hopi claims. Now 24 Navajo households will be connected to the grid for the first time. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation has struck a deal to bring electricity to nearly 24 homes for the very first time. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, many of the residents have lived their entire lives without power.
The subgrant agreement with the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority will connect 23 families to the grid in the community of Tonalea. At a recent signing ceremony, local officials and residents joined Navajo President Jonathan Nez as he finalized the deal. They spoke about the challenges and expenses they've endured for years because of the lack of electricity. Tonalea resident Selena Slim said she's lived off the grid her entire life and regularly spends $75 on gasoline for her generator. When schools went online during the pandemic, her costs went up to provide internet service for her children. The homes set to receive electricity are located in what's known as the former Bennett Freeze area. It's 1.5 million acres on which the federal government prohibited development and even basic repairs to homes for more than 4 decades because of a land dispute with the Hopi tribe. The American Power Association estimates more than a quarter of households on the Navajo Nation aren't connected to the grid, and they make up 75% of all unelectrified homes in the U.S. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
This week, members of the Native community celebrated the removal of boarding school panels at Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado. The panels removed from the clock tower were said to be inaccurate and represent the troubling era of Indian boarding schools in the U.S. A couple years ago, the college established a committee to examine its origins as a Native American boarding school. In April, Fort Lewis College hosted a virtual roundtable with similar institutions. The college is reflecting on past wrongs and working on healing. U.S. Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh reflected on the 2021 Labor Day holiday by honoring the resilience of the workforce. It's been a difficult year for many people across the country, including in tribal communities impacted by COVID-19. As workers and employers continue to navigate daily life moving forward in the pandemic, Walsh says tribal communities are being included in federal support.
Anytime that I've had either visited in person a tribal community or on a phone, on Zoom meetings we've had, the importance of workforce development, the importance of apprenticeship programs, making sure that we're supporting the nations with the ability for people to be able to get a good paying job and support their family. And then also working on other issues such as infrastructure, making sure that the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the Build Back Better agenda, which is the CARES economy infrastructure bill, that we continue to move those two bills forward, because it's long-term investments in people, workforces, and also our physical infrastructure in our country.
Walsh says there are many opportunities for tribal communities, and the administration will continue to strengthen relationships. A judge in Arizona ruled against the Yavapai Prescott Indian tribe this week, which sought to stop sports betting. The Arizona Republic reports the tribe sued the state, arguing only voters can decide which types of gaming to have in Arizona, and also claimed it will hurt tribal businesses. Maricopa County Superior Court Judge James Smith denied the motion to stop sports betting, which begins Thursday. Petitions have been filed asking the U.S. Supreme Court to review the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in Brackeen versus Holland. The case challenges the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act. Tribal defendants are vowing to continue to fight to protect the more than 40-year-old law intended to keep Native children with Native families. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 8th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Charles Blanke. The producer is myself, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Dan Raphael, Josh Salem, Anthony Lizowitz, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, Lily Bolke, and Mary Sherman. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. The podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandwise. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO is Juneteenth Radio at 8 a.m., followed by Radio Zine at 9.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The United States is mired in a healthcare crisis, separate from the COVID pandemic. Our healthcare system, which is largely for profit, leaves many Americans without adequate coverage. It doesn't even perform better, as demonstrated by high rates of infant mortality and low life expectancy for Americans. I spoke about this with author Tom Hartman, who has what he describes as a simple solution for our healthcare problems, Medicare for all. Tom is a trained psychotherapist and a New York Times best-selling author of 32 books. He has a popular progressive talk radio show, also simulcast on TV in approximately 60 million North American homes. Tom has written multiple books in the Hidden History series, including The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment and The Hidden History of the War on Voting. His next book is The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. We are lucky to have him on our program today.
Welcome, Tom.
Well, thank you. It's great talking to you again.
Tom, why did you write this book as part of your Hidden History series, and why now?
Right now, I think healthcare is probably more top of mind for a lot of people than any other time in our recent history, because we're experiencing a pandemic, and in the midst of this, we've got 30 or 40 million people who are under or uninsured, arguably, well over 100 million people underinsured. And we're seeing bankruptcies from people getting sick just skyrocketing. They had been averaging around a half a million a year for the last couple of decades. And last year they were over 700,000. This year they'll be over a million. And these are mostly people who got sick with COVID and as a consequence have huge hospital bills or doctor bills that they can't pay and their insurance companies are only covering parts of. So I think that it's a really critical time to be having a conversation about how we reinvent our healthcare system so that it actually serves everybody in the country rather than just, a few billionaires in the health insurance industry.
Did I correctly read that in the U.S. we have the worst of all worlds, healthcare that's more expensive and less effective, especially in terms of life expectancy?
That's true. That's absolutely true. And in fact, in terms of things like maternal mortality or child mortality, we are in third world category. We're below, I believe, all other developed countries. Possible there's one that we're competing with in those categories. Literally the only area, which, by the way, is the area that you will find all over the internet being held up as proof that American healthcare is wonderful. The only area where we do better than most other countries in the world is breast cancer. And the only reason for that has nothing to do with our health insurance system or our medical care system. It has to do with the absolute extraordinary efforts over a period of about a decade and a half, two decades, of a group of very, very committed women raising consciousness about breast cancer and particularly teaching women how to do self-exam. So that's the one area in healthcare where we're doing well, and that's because of early diagnosis. But in every other realm, we pay anywhere from a third to twice as much, a third more to twice as much for health insurance and healthcare in general as any other country in the world. We pay about twice as much for pharmaceuticals as any other country in the world. And the average American family spends about $3,000 a year on healthcare that no other, it's basically a tax that is not hit, that doesn't hit the residents of any other developed country in the world.
So I'm hoping you'll help us by defining a phrase you like and which our listeners have heard mentioned by some progressive political candidates. What exactly is Medicare for all?
Well, Medicare is a single-payer healthcare system. The single payer is the government. And all the bills come to one source, and that one source pays all the bills. Medicare, as it was put into place in the 1966 or 67, 65, I forget which year it was, but when Medicare was put into place, was designed, Robert Ball, the guy who actually wrote the Medicare legislation, designed it so that with just literally changing a few sentences, it could become a national healthcare system, much like Canada had at that time. Canada's was called Medicare. It started in one province, Saskatchewan. Other provinces wanted it. They got it. Eventually, the federal government stepped in to backstop the individual provinces. My guess is that's probably how it's going to play out here in the United States. Right now, there is a law that prevents that from happening, that both California and Vermont have passed single-payer legislation, but they haven't been able to implement it, because if a state does that right now under current law, all Medicaid and Medicare money stops coming into the state, or at least the state can't reallocate it through their system. And that is a small change to law that has been proposed year after year after year by Democrats and progressives in Congress. And of course, the health insurance industry is fighting it tooth and nail. But, you know, that's what it is, single payer health care. And hopefully that's how we'll get it.
So that leads into the next question. Is the term Medicare for All completely synonymous with single payer health care, or is it one system that you are in favor of?
Well, it depends on whose definition you're using. Medicare itself is a single-payer system, but it only pays 80% of expenses. That was put into place in the 60s. It was a demand made by white racist Southern senators who did not want black people to have access to health care. Racism has been the principal animating force behind our lack of a comprehensive health care system in this country for over 100 years, as I document fairly exhaustively in the book. These white senators from the South wanted to make sure that if a poor black person got sick, which was the majority of black people at that time in the South, then they wouldn't be able to afford the copay, so they wouldn't go get care. And this goes back to the scientific racism theories of Frederick Hoffman, who toured the United States in the late 1800s and early 20th century, pitching his idea that if we simply denied health care to black people, they were so genetically inferior, they would all eventually die out. And that animated the AMA, that animated our policy, that became part of the reason why there's this 20% hole in Medicare in the 1960s. So if you really wanted it to be single payer, you have to do away with that 20% hole and have Medicare pay all expenses and then extend it to everybody in the country, which is, by the way, what is being proposed by the people who are the advocates of Medicare for All. But if we were to simply take our current Medicare system with its 20% hole, where you have to buy a private health insurance policy if you're over 65 to supplement, you know, it's called Medigap, to fill that gap, to supplement your Medicare policy, then I'm not quite sure you could call it single payer. It would be more like that's American Medicare. But like I said, Canada calls their single payer system Medicare, as do other countries. Pretty straightforward stuff.
Thanks. Have there been any serious previous efforts to develop Medicare for All?
There have been a bunch of previous efforts. Teddy Roosevelt pitched this in 1912. Franklin Roosevelt pitched it in 1936. Harry Truman pitched it in 1947. John Kennedy pitched it in 1961. In every case, the majority of the pushback that they got came from the insurance industry and from the white racist, mostly in the South, who did not want black people to have equal access to health care and were afraid that a national health care system would integrate the hospitals and doctor's offices, which was something they were able to succeed in preventing right up until the 1960s. So although Medicare has been the most successful racial integration program in history, in less than 1 year we integrated every hospital in America simply because those were the terms under which they would get the money. But, you know, we need to clean this up and tweak it a little better.
So I actually practiced cancer medicine in Canada for years, and I thought it was pretty wonderful. But people here always point to the, oh, there are no blankets in hospitals, or say it takes 5 years to get a shoulder MRI under single-payer coverage. Do you think there truly are disadvantages like that with Medicare for All?
I think with any kind of medical system, you're going to have a difficult time load balancing supply and demand. When Louise and I moved to Washington, D.C. back about 12 years ago, we literally could not find a doctor in D.C., and Louise needed to get some medication that she needs to take on a daily basis. And every single medical practice, I mean, we called everybody. Louise spent days on the phone trying to find a doctor. Every doctor was filled up. I know when I needed back surgery, I had to jump through a whole lot of hoops and had to wait quite a while to get that back surgery. With Louise in D.C., we ended up going to a concierge practice, where you pay the doctor up front, you pay him a couple $1,000s a year just to be your doctor, and then you go see them and they send you another bill. which is, by the way, spreading all across the United States now, because we have these huge shortages. We have areas in this country where there are doctor shortages, or at least GP shortages. There are other places where there's shortages in particular specialties. A national healthcare system will substantially ameliorate that, and stopping the cap on the number of people who can go to medical school in order to just, you know, artificially inflate the pay of docs is probably also a useful thing to do in the United States. So right now, as anybody who has had, you know, elective surgery can tell you, there are long waits, or there can be long waits in the United States, depending on the policy you have, depending on the part of the country you live in, and depending on, you know, how much money you're willing to kick in, or, you know, if you're willing to go to a place that charges a premium that you may have to pay. That's not a system that is lacking in allocations or lacking in rationing, which is the word that they love to use. They say, oh, they ration healthcare in Canada. Well, we ration healthcare here in the United States. We just do it based on ability to pay rather than severity of medical condition. And I think severity of medical condition is really the appropriate point where you say, okay, you know, this person has, you know, a cancer at risk of metastasis. We're going to take that out tomorrow. Or this person has a broken bone. We're going to fix it this afternoon. Whereas that person has some arthritis in their hip, and sometime in the next year or two, they're going to need a hip replacement. Let's put that off 3 months before we start doing the preliminary work. That just makes sense to me.
Certainly everybody who needed frontline chemotherapy for colorectal cancer in Canada got it, which was wonderful for practitioners and for the patients.
Louise and I lived for 10 years or so in Vermont, you know, right across the border from Canada. And there were not all kinds of Canadians coming to America looking for medical care. In fact, I never saw one. But every weekend in Montpelier, Vermont, where we lived, a bus would pull into the center of town, and older people, people on Medicare mostly, would fill the bus, and it would drive up north to Toronto to go to the pharmacies for people to pick up their prescriptions. We have such a dysfunctional system here. It's just shocking.
You compare taxes used to pay for health care to taxes that might be used to fund a fire department, for example. Do you think that argument resonates with opponents?
Well, I don't know about opponents. I'm not sure that any argument resonates with them. And this is a conversation that we haven't had in a big way in the United States really since the 1950s. And we really first started having in an honest way in the 1880s and 1890s, when we went from private fire departments that only put out the fire on your house if you had their medallion on the front of your house, meaning you paid your fee to them every year, and private police departments in many parts of the country, and no public schools of any consequence, to by 1900 public schools being a thing that had spread out of Boston in the 1890s and across the country within a decade or two. And we kind of all agreed that, you know, if your house is on fire, that's everybody's problem. That's a community problem. It's bigger than something you can individually deal with. Therefore, dealing with houses on fire should be considered part of the commons. If you've got a child that needs an education, that's something that's beyond the capability of most individuals, particularly if they have to work a job, and there's benefit to the entire community. So that's appropriately part of the commons being the things that we all collectively own and administer and fund. And I would say, you know, if we've agreed for 100 years now that if your house is on fire, we will all collectively pay to get a fire department and a fire truck out there, isn't your body as valuable as a house? If your body is metaphorically on fire with, you know, cancer or disease or injury, isn't that as urgent a consideration as somebody's house being on fire? It certainly seems that way to me. And I think now is the time to start saying healthcare should be part of our commons, just like fire and police are, and schools.
I think that leads beautifully to another question. You had a big chapter title with a big concept, healthcare, right or privilege? I think I can guess your answer, but would you like to explain it?
Well, that is really what it comes down to. I mean, in the United States, you have a right to an education. If you feel that your child is not being appropriately educated in school, you can literally sue the government. There are areas where we have very specific rights that we can enforce in court, but healthcare is not one of them, which, you know, as I said, I think is crazy. Healthcare has been defined as a right by the United Nations. We signed that treaty defining it as a right. We just never applied it to our own country. Healthcare is defined as a right by 33 out of the 34 OECD countries, the richest countries in the world, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. We are the only one that doesn't recognize healthcare as a right. And I think that's morally criminal and, you know, and a tragedy at a societal and a personal level, and really only serves to benefit the people who are just getting obscenely rich running these health insurance industry scams from Medicare Advantage on down to private health insurance.
Thanks. You had so many astonishing percentages and other figures. You said that 80% of Americans would have to borrow or beg for cash if they were hit with an unexpected, simple $1,000 expense. That scares me, and I presume our listeners. Can you explain how single-payer health care or Medicare for All help Americans avoid a financial crisis?
Well, it pays the bills. I mean, it's very straightforward. In some countries, you have medical or health care systems where there's a small deductible. You know, we may have that here, but right now, most Americans have health insurance policies that have deductibles and copays and whatnot that add up to multiple thousands of dollars a year. And in a country where 80% of the country can't deal with a $1,000 expense, half of the country can't deal with a $400 expense, that's just not sustainable.
So getting down to the nitty-gritty, you had a pretty radical-sounding solution. Have the government buy the insurance companies. How would that work? How would that help?
Well, one of the problems that we have right now is the Supreme Court has ruled on multiple occasions, Citizens United is the most well-known one, that if a corporation or a billionaire want to massively influence politics or even own a politician, that's not called corruption or bribery, that's called free speech, and it's protected by the First Amendment. As a consequence of that, when you try to take on a giant industry like the health insurance industry, or in this, the one that's playing out right in front of us right now is pharmaceuticals, you've got AARP saying, let's let the government negotiate drug prices for Medicare. And you've got the drug companies running ads on TV right now saying, whoa, if you let that happen, then we're not going to be able to get drugs to people on Medicare, which is just complete BS. So if there